Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. I'm going to explain a few things in this space this morning that I wouldn't normally take the time to explain, in no small part because one of the centerpieces of this reflection, of this exploration, is a video, which of course translates very poorly to a podcast. So as I've mentioned in the printed material about this, and as will be present on the podcast, there is a link to that particular video on our website in the blurb posting on our homepage. So if you're listening to this on the podcast and you're wondering what video I'm talking about, go to the website, thetablewinnipeg.com, and you will find a link to the video, and you can watch that and sort of fill out the literal picture. So having decided to spend a couple of weeks exploring grief, and in the run-up to Christmas, of all things, I wanted to offer a brief, not apology, I don't feel apologetic about this, but a bit of a caveat. Many of us may know this by experience, many more by having heard it said and feeling like it makes sense in theory. Grief is both common and complex. It's both ordinary and extraordinary, if you will. We all experience loss. And if you're wondering about me saying all, I try to stay clear of superlatives as a bit of a practice, at least to check in with myself before I use them. So if you're wondering about my all there, I would encourage you to think about the loss of normal, for example, that we experienced during the pandemic, a global event. So that's the common part. But if I just stay with that illustration, not everyone experienced that global event as a loss, which might strike you as curious if you did experience that as a loss of something. I was on a climbing site in Alberta, sort of just as the pandemic was coming to a close. People were out and about. It was outside as well, so early days of that, you know, people kind of reemerging. And I'm overhearing conversations about SERP. It's a busy site, a sport climbing site, so people are sort of closer together than might otherwise be the case. And one of these guys was like, man, I love this. Like, the government just sent me money and I went climbing. Because I don't think they were experiencing a lot of loss, for example. So we experienced it differently, and that's the complicated or complex part, right? And so just even in a big sort of blunt instrument illustration like that, that's an illustration that common and complex interplay, we can illustrate that without even having to talk about the loss of any particular person, for example, or more acute relational or human loss. So it's with that in view that what I want to do is enter exploring this topic through a different portal than ideas. We'll get to the ideas soon enough, but I want to enter through the portal of music. Don't know how this works for you, but my experience with enjoying music and musicians is that it seems to happen on several different levels, usually simultaneously for me. Some of those are annoying to other people around me. I can't go into the mall without noticing the music. You know, I'm meant to not notice it, I realize, but I do. And at this time of the year, I can't enter the mall without noticing it and generally being annoyed by it, but that's just me. So there are some artists, because of that high attenuation for me, there are some artists that consistently connect for me or that I keep returning to over and over, and there are some where I hear one song and I love it, and then I listen to the album and think, well, there's a reason that was the lead single, and then I eventually remove the album from my library. Their first offering was the best one. And then there are some that just sort of keep popping up because I'm intrigued by the way that they think, but I wouldn't sort of say I don't have them on frequent rotation, right? They're not always in my ears or in my space, but they kind of keep showing up in the bigger milieu of what I'm listening to because there's something interesting about them. For me, Leith Ross is in that last category. I am fascinated, and Leith is a relatively young artist. I'm fascinated by the way that Leith puts songs together. I'm not going to get all music nerdy about this, but when it comes to their musical style, which often gets labeled indie folk, I think they would self-describe as a folk artist, they're not always in my sweet spot musically, and to be fair, that's not their job. But the music that they make is, from my vantage point, consistently creative, it's consistently interesting, and it has this kind of, I would say, kind of careful delicacy or thoughtfulness about it that that I really do enjoy. But what keeps me coming back to Leith's music, personally, most often and most substantially, is their perspective as a songwriter. I once heard Leith in an interview talk about why they ended up back in Winnipeg, because this is sort of home turf, but then they'd moved off to Toronto to kind of break the scene there when their career started to open up a bit more. And they said that they looked around at the scene in Toronto and realized that they just had to do this ridiculous nonstop hustle to be, in their words, one of the three folk artists who made it in Toronto. And then, in that same interview, Leith was like, and I was talking to a friend about the prices of rent in Winnipeg, and that was it. I'm home. Like, I can live here and make music. And it's a different scene. It feels different. And when I listen to Leith's music, I feel like I'm sitting with a young philosopher who has more wisdom than their years can account for. Now, Leith is also a trans person and has come out as an adult, and so that journey, and this is all public information, that journey has also deeply informed their perspective about things, to be sure. And when I listen to Leith's music, among other things, it gives me hope for the future. I feel like when I listen to the art they're making, I'm like, you know what, the kids are going to be okay as long as those of us who are older than them don't screw it up. As long as we don't get in the way, they're going to figure it out. So I realize it's an indefensible perspective, but it's one that has hope in it for me. So when Leith's new album dropped this past September, I downloaded it, I put it in my earbuds, I went outside to do yard work with Leith's voice in my ears, and the first song just stopped me in my tracks. Like, probably literally, although when this happens, I apparently sometimes don't notice unless someone points out to me that I've stopped actually moving. The opening cut is this song called Grieving. The opening cut is a song called Grieving. Like, I don't know if you ever think about album order. Not everybody does, but it's actually kind of a big deal. What a curious way to open an album with a song about grief. And it's not a banger. Like, it's not tongue in cheek, right? Like, it just leans right in to what's going on. So at first pass, that seemed to me like a curious way to open an album. Maybe it's like, what is this? Is this bold? Is this kind of mopey? Is this like maybe sort of an indie screw you? I'm going to make the art that I want to make and no industry conventions are going to stop me. Like, up yours, if you can't get past the opening song, I don't need you. Like, what? Like, you know, what is this? What's going on? And I don't get to know that. But for sure, not a simple choice in the sense that it can feel, from an album point of view, it can feel a little bit like starting in the deep end with no chance to wade in slow. It's a little bit like just coming to the edge of the pool and getting tossed in. And at first, I was a bit put off, honestly. My problem, not Leith's problem. I was a bit put off, but then the more attention I paid to the song, the more my perspective sort of came around. And then I went to look up the music video, and that's when the penny dropped. This is a love song. It's just that it's backwards. It defies convention in so many ways. That probably shouldn't be a surprise given who the artist is, because Leith's story is, in ways that I've already gestured toward, not a conventional one. I'm going to suffice it to say, as sort of a summary of all of that, that there are lots of prevailing norms, both industry norms, personal norms, that Leith flies in the face of, and no surprise, that calls out to me. In this case, it speaks to me about ways that I might want or even just plain need to reconsider how I think about grief and grieving. So what we're going to do is we're going to watch the video. And again, if you're listening to this on the podcast, the link to the video is in the blurb. So I'm going to play the video, and we'll put up the lyrics. And then just keep this question in your mind as we watch this, okay? What I would invite us to talk about after we watch this together is a couple of questions. What sorts of reconsiderations of your ideas about grief does the song itself raise? What sort of reconsiderations of some of your ideas about grief do the images in the video raise? Okay? And like lots of Leith's videos, and this is thoughtfully put together, but also Leith is telling their story. Like it's profoundly personal. Lots of the footage here is from an actual event. That'll make a little more sense when we get there.
Now we all learn to love with the clarity of grief.
So the two questions that I suggested before we watched. Also, if I may, what sort of ever-renewing fount of creativity does it take inside of an artist? My word. Anyway, whew, love that. And not least of all because it is an explosion of queer joy. Like, it's just, from the opening moments, it's so, so powerful. So a few spaces for queer folks where they can feel like they can be themselves and to have Leith share with the world a community that's having that experience together. It's a pretty big deal. Questions that I suggested. Reconsiderations of grief that the song, lyrically, ideologically, perhaps musically, it is after all a jig, raises for you about grief. Or reconsiderations of grief that some of the images from the video might stir for you. There's some really significant metaphors that get rearranged over the course of that short video about common metaphors for grief and common ideas about grief. So anyway, that's what's going on inside of me, but I want to hear from you. What sorts of things did that make you go hmm about when it comes to ideas about grief? Well, let that stuff perk. I'm going to offer us a couple of not especially perhaps new or novel ideas here about grief, but just some, almost think of these like as these ideas maybe as sort of like sentence stems, starters, if you will, starting ideas that can help us continue to sort of think about the central idea of the song, which is this notion that grief is love running backwards. And as I've sort of reflected on that image of that over the last couple of weeks, what has come to mind is as tides, ocean tides, not something that we might not all be familiar with them, given that we live a long ways from any oceans here in the middle of the prairies. But if you've ever been around tides, especially maybe if they were new to you, depending on the setting, the combination of subtlety and power can be both profound and really quite hazardous. I know as somebody who enjoys being on the water and having had a couple of occasions to be on the ocean when the tide was running a particular direction on a paddleboard or in a kayak, and coming back from a paddle later and talking to a local, and they were like, "You went where, when?" And not because it was dangerous, but just because, man, you paddled uphill the whole way because the tide was coming in and you were going out or whatever. But you can't necessarily see that when you're in the midst of it. The power's there, but it's not necessarily visible. So I think when I think about grief, that those parts of that image are important to me, and also partly because even though they're not visible, grief can sometimes feel like a tide that's sort of pulling me back to something that I cherished. It's trying to pull me back to something in the past. It's like love running backwards. I think that metaphor of love running backwards, grief is love running backwards, I think it matters for a bunch of reasons, but one is that it can possibly reframe grief not as a flaw or as a failure, not as something that we should do and get done, it's not a chore, but as an expression of deep connection. So if I wanted to break that metaphor down a little bit, I might think about it this way. Love is something that when it's in good repair, or even just when it has a pulse, honestly, I think can move us forward. And what I mean by that is it can move us toward connection, it can move us toward being present, it can move us toward a shared investment in the future with other people, it can move us deeper into shared commitments. Why do I do this difficult thing for or with the people that I do it with? Well, one of the reasons, one of the words that I would use for that is love. I do it because of love. And when we lose someone, that forward energy, that motion has, we could say, nowhere to go. Or at least, until we reconsider it, it can't go where it was going, right? It needs to be redirected and reframed in some way. And so in some ways, grief becomes this reversal. Our minds, our hearts run back through things like memories, through shared hopes, through unfinished business, through unfinished conversations. So we could say, lots of ways to consider all these things. We could say that grief is the same energy as love, but flowing in the opposite direction in terms of our lived experience. It's one way to think about it. And one of the reasons I think that that tide has so much power, I'm going to put this into an equation, which I do with some trepidation because, you know, unless you're doing it at the very highest levels, math is fairly precise stuff. And using an equation for something like grief has this inherent danger of being reductionistic. But I'm going to use an equation anyway because it might help us visualize something. Think about it this way. Grief equals love plus the shock of absence, or the experience of absence. Grief equals love plus the experience of absence. One of the things that happens to us in those kinds of experiences is that our emotional brain, not a technical term, but it might help us sort of think about a bunch of ideas in a simple way. Emotionally, the brain wants to revisit those moments of connection. And one of the reasons why our brain and by extension our mind does that is to help us make sense of the experience of loss, to have a story about it, to have a way of thinking about it. Maybe because, well, there's lots of becauses here, but one of the becauses, I think, for this in our culture at this time is because we're so obsessed with youth, among other things, right? And maintaining either its experience or its reality or whatever, however we want to think about that, but just being present to this. You know, that's why we think it's a compliment when somebody says we don't look our age and they mean we look younger. Like, there's a whole lot of things going on all around this all the time. And when we stay in that space deeply, especially deeply and unconsidered, we can start to treat grief categorically as an enemy, as something to be at best dispensed with, gotten through, gotten over. But what if, as part of this sort of reframing experience, we reconsider that? What if we think about grief potentially as not an enemy, but our mind's way, I would even say ourselves, our person's way of honoring the things that have mattered and do matter to us. For the folk fest people among us, or people who enjoy folk musicians, because their instruments are more prone to this in some ways, but that whole tuning while you talk to the crowd thing, you know, because acoustic instruments go out of tune based on the climate they're in. And so, you know, but it's an interruption, isn't it? Right? And so you've probably watched any number of artists, if you go to live music events outside, especially in the summer, having to do that little chore and trying to find some way to talk about it to the crowd because it's a glitch, you know? And one of the common ways that it gets talked about is with a sentence, something like, we tune because we care. Just, you know, hang in there. I'm doing this so you don't have to listen to an out-of-tune guitar and I care about your experience. I think sort of if we think about the grief experience as a little bit like that, we tune because we care, we grieve because we care, right? It interrupts the flow of our lives. It interrupts the story we were already living in. It's disruptive, sometimes profoundly, acutely, shatteringly disruptive. If I wanted to stay with the folk musician metaphor for a bit, some grief experiences don't feel like the guitar went out of tune. They feel like I put the strap around my neck and picked it up to play and the neck fell off. I didn't have a playable instrument anymore. I can't say I tune because I care. I have to say, hold on, this won't work. I have to find another way forward if we're going to do this, right? So sometimes the magnitude of our grief experiences can be all over the map. But what happens to even the neck fell off the guitar experiences, if we think about them not as our enemy, but as an entry into something else? This might seem like a facile illustration, but I feel like I'm starting to learn something about this, especially from my Indigenous relations, who have had to navigate a world of systematic oppression for generations, and they've learned some things along the way that are coming back in a different shape now that they have some agency collectively again in a different way. I walked in this morning, I touched on this earlier, I walked in this morning and some things that I was counting on being here weren't, that were uniquely important this morning. So the projector was missing, for example, nowhere to be found. Okay, this is funny and kind of, I had a dream last night that the projector was missing. This is a true story. I'm not going to make anything of it. It just, I think it's my story about why my brain did that is because I knew it was important this morning. And my brain was trying to make all the bits fit into one story. And so it was like, projector's missing. You should probably have a plan for that. Right? So just trying to organize in advance, which our brains do all the time. And then I came in and it was missing. And I was like, huh, how about that? That the work that our brains are doing all the time of kind of how do I kind of navigate this possibility of loss, maybe that's what we need to learn how to think differently about. Because the next part of that experience for me here was, so I'm like, oh, and I've got less time than usual because of events outside of here this morning that kind of got me here a little later than I had planned to, and that's fine. But I came in, and I could have had sort of an internal full-on crisis. It's about my identity as a person with responsibilities in this space. How will people's experience be impacted? Are we going to be able to do the thing that I had planned? Do we need another plan? I don't have another plan. It's all built around this video. Now what? And all of that stuff, right? But what my indigenous relatives keep reminding me of is there's more going on here than you can see. It'll happen when it happens. You don't need to get in a flap about this. Also, there's other people involved. And there's going to be help. You're not in this alone. And sure enough, a couple minutes later, Lisa came in. She was here early this morning. I didn't call Lisa and say, could you come in early because I need some help? She was just here.
Which never.
That's yours to say, not mine, right? But it wasn't anything I was anticipating. And it was lovely to have help. And when I went upstairs thinking, how am I going to solve this projector problem? I realized that they'd sort of moved the technological part of the party upstairs. And the idea occurred that maybe they'd move the projector as well. So I started looking around in unconventional places that were high so it could shine over dancers. And sure enough, I found it up on a very high shelf on a post in the middle of the room. And here it is. Problem solved. Thinking about it as an opportunity for something to be made differently than my plan changed my internal, my emotional experience of it not being according to my plan. I reframed it. It was still a problem I wanted to solve, but it was no longer a crisis. Emotionally, it was no longer a crisis. It was now, this sounds like a bumper sticker, but it was now a sort of an opportunity, right? It was a different way to think about what I was experiencing, and it really shifted my experience of it. Reframing grief as love running backwards, I think, sort of can be like that. Now, that little equation that I mentioned, grief equals love plus the shock of absence, one of the things I don't like about it is that it tempts me to be simplistic and say that deeper connection equals deeper grief, period. And I would like to say that both, you know, connection and grief are more complicated than that. And so I don't want to use that kind of math here. But I also don't want to ignore the fact that there is a relationship between those aspects of grief, between love and the shock of absence, which is partly why the illustration that you mentioned, Jody, young adult tragically lost in an accident, and so on, right? Child is lost, those kind of things. That we do have a different experience with those because of the math of this as well. And also because of the future loss, right? That's one of the reasons why we think differently, experience those things differently. So there is a relationship there, but I don't want us to get stuck on the math as much as I think the equation might help us remember an idea. Grief equals love plus the shock of absence. It's a way of explaining or entering into an explanation of the experience of grief that we're having, but I don't think it's a good place to stop. So, by way of illustrating some of the less simplistic aspects of this, I am grieved whenever I encounter needless violence. As soon as I wrote that sentence, I was like, is there needful violence? Different topic, right? It's already a complicated idea. When I encounter violence, it feels egregiously unnecessary, might be another way to think about it, wherever it occurs. But I don't grieve for the dead in the Gaza conflict or the war in Ukraine the same way I grieve my mom or my dad. But we all bundle it under grief, right? So to kind of bring us a little closer to some ideas that might kind of wrap this consideration up, one of the questions I want to speak to a little bit is how might reframing grief as love running backwards potentially be helpful to us? One of the ways that reframing grief as love running backwards has the potential to help us is that it can reduce shame or self-judgment. It can help us dial down the "I should be over this" experience that we sometimes have. Apologizing for being too emotional, not moving on fast enough, those kinds of things. That stuff can all get quite helpfully reconsidered if we think about the grief experience as love running in reverse. I don't think we're nearly, I could be wrong about this, but I don't think we're nearly as inclined to be apologetic for loving too much when those things are in good health, at least, as we would be inclined to feel apologetic for grieving too much or too visibly. To be smacked over by a wave of grief years after the date of a loss because something triggered that for us, something reminded us of it, and then to feel like we need to apologize for, you know, I'm sorry, that was years ago, I should be over this by now, all of that business, right? Well, says who is a starting place, but also if we're framing grief primarily as an enemy to be vanquished, that kind of makes sense as a response, doesn't it? If I was stronger, if I was more sorted, if I was, pick a self-denigrating, self-critical perspective and say I should be more of something, I would have be done with this. So I'm sorry. Sorry that I haven't done the work. Pick one, right?
It's just sorry I'm making this awkward.
But there's that, of course, right? But also, why is it awkward? Like, how much of that is on me? And how much of it is on this wider context that we're in? Like, sometimes it's awkward because our culture is shit at this. And that we need to acknowledge that and, of course, be sensitive to it. I'm not trying to encourage us to just sort of fall into self-centeredness and say, screw you, I'm going to have the experience I'm going to have with blithe regard for all those around me. Right? So, again, balance. But I think our culture is so wildly out of balance on this, generally speaking, that perhaps being not apologetic for grief, explaining it, but without apology, might actually help the wider whole shift a little bit over time. That came as a surprise to me. Give me a moment. Is how I try to remember those experiences when I have them publicly. I don't always remember, but I'm a feeler. They happen, right? So I'm trying to learn as a practice for myself, especially in settings with strangers, to be able to go, that story still really hits me right in my emotional center. I'll be right back. Okay, let's carry on, you know? I don't have to apologize to explain. And my body's, my neurobiology is going to do what it's going to do. It's my gravity. And trauma as a big category, of course, is one of the ways that popular culture gets to look in on some of that research, right? Well, and what a kind, it's a kind consideration to not want to burden others. And as you pointed out, it's not a working assumption that they will be able to connect with my experience in this or me with their experience in this, right? So yes, again, so that's sort of the balance part of it, I think. And also the emotional intelligence skill set of kind of reading the room, which is gets, again, to our neurobiology, among other things, gets immediately harder when we're having a powerful emotional experience, right? The bigger the feelings, sort of the more busy the processor is with those things and the less readily available horsepower we have for that reading the context part of it sometimes, right? Just a couple more quick things and we'll wrap this up. If thinking about love running backwards has the potential to help us reduce things like shame or self-judgment, it can also help us to encourage compassion, especially self-compassion. Being kind to ourselves about our own grief experience, which grief is not linear, despite some famous representations about the grief process that have suggested that when we don't think about them more deeply. Kubler-Ross, thank you very much. So, you know, like, it's just not that simple, right? That doesn't mean those aren't helpful ideas, but we have to be careful with them. So we need to be kind with ourselves and with others, just approach the whole thing with some tenderness. And also, thinking about grief as love running backwards, I think has the potential to help us build community around grief. And that's one of the things I loved about Leith's video, is just this, I mean, and these are young people for the most part, chronologically in that story of Leith and their community, and they're just like, nope, we are gonna love out loud now. I don't think those friendships are any more perfect than any of ours. We just saw them in a 3.5-minute video. How lovely, right? That's a snapshot. I'm sure that there's plenty of complexity there, and there are also people who are like, I think maybe I'll think of something good to say about that jerk after they're dead, but right now it's just all conflict and whatever. Of course. But the potential for the idea that grief is love running backwards to inform the way we relate to one another in community now. I'm going to say this kind thing now. I'm going to affirm this now. We're talking about this, about Ian's encouragement of, you know, of your daughter, right? Like of educators, of support, of any context. It doesn't have to be formally vertical, where we get the chance to encourage someone or say that kind thing to them. I think one of the dangers here is we might approach that as though we should say it now because you never know when they're going to die, and that's a fear-based thing. I want to be a little bit careful with that one. This is an opportunity. We don't know. I mean, we know the end in the sense that we're all going to, you know, nobody gets out of this alive, right? But the details we don't know. There's lots of mystery there. And so just taking the opportunity to be kind, to be encouraging, to be as present as we can, to see as deeply as we're able. And there's all kinds of things that get in the way, of course. So that as we're able, I think, is a really important part of that notion as well. But thinking about grief as love running backwards can help us occasionally just kind of go, oh yeah, that's right. I should say that now. It's a way of grieving now, if I think about grief as love. To say to somebody, you're really good at that. Think about that as grief. That's a mind shift, isn't it? We can think about it as kindness, of course. We can think about it as love, of course. But what happens if we think about it as grieving now? Reshapes grief, doesn't it? I'm gonna tell the people that I love them as active, life-giving grief.
Good grief.
Yeah, peace.